Good morning. This is Catherine Stamper, and you're listening to Present Time on WBTV-LP Burlington 99.3 FM, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. And I am delighted to host in the studio this morning Bill Schubart, Vermont author and individual extraordinaire, who's here to talk about his newest book, The Correctional Facility, which is a modern journey into Dante's Inferno and the ensuing metastasis of evil. Welcome to the studio, Bill.
Thank you so much, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be here.
I love hosting you whenever you come out with a new book because they're always so fun and so interesting to talk about. I want to start, though, by giving you the opportunity to reintroduce yourself to listeners. You may be new to some folks out there.
Well, I was born in New York City, so technically I'm not a Vermonter. My mother moved here in 1947 when I was 2 years old, and I've lived here ever since. I grew up in Morrisville in a French-Canadian family. I went by the name Bill Couture when I was young. Just have, you know, started several businesses, recording studio, record company, a media company, Resolution, and retired about 12 years ago and have been writing. It gave me the opportunity to write, which I have not. And I've served on a lot of boards and, you know.
So a very distinguished business career as well as a distinguished career of service, public service here in Vermont, which if I'm accurate, I know continues in many ways. So again, so happy to have you in the studio this morning. So we're here to talk about your new book, and I want to invite you to introduce audience members to Dante Alighieri, the author of Dante's Divine Comedy. What should folks know about this 13th century dude?
Well, it's Dante has been an extremely powerful force in poetry and literature for the last 700 years. He was a Florentine poet, born in, I think, 1270 or somewhere in there, and lived about 50 or 60 years, which in those days was a long life. And he was the first poet not to write in Latin. He walked away from Latin because you were expected to write in Latin. And he wrote in colloquial language, which endeared him to many and, of course, enraged academics. The work he's most known for is called The Divine Comedy, and it's basically Hell, Purgatory, and Heaven. The Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso. It's been translated several times. And if you do look into it, I really urge you to look at the illustrations that were done by a French artist, I think in the 18th or 19th century, Gustave Doré, because they are almost as perfect as one could get when you read Dante.
Great. So I wonder about your personal history with this book, meaning with Dante's Divine Comedy. Like, when did you first encounter it, and what's your journey been like with that book?
In the butt room at Phillips Exeter Academy, and that of course requires an explanation. Students were allowed to smoke if their parents gave them permission. And in the basement was this cinder block hole called the butt room. And that's where all the cool people hung out. And in those days, it was sort of beatniks. And I wanted to be one of them. So I would be down there. And I saw a copy sitting on a table, and I picked it up. I was attracted by the illustrations. And to make a long story short, I read the whole thing. And I was absolutely thunderstruck because it brought back my early Catholic catechism experience. Even though I was born in New York City into a German Jewish family, my stepfather's family was Quebecois French Canadian. I was baptized at the age of 4, you know, went to catechism, knew the Mass in French, Latin, and English as an altar boy. And the nuns would come down from Quebec every Saturday. And they were extremely good at painting the horrors of sin. And we would be, they would talk to us about, do you know what it feels like to burn in a fire for eternity? Surely you've burned yourself on a kitchen stove or a wood stove. Now imagine that forever.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, there'd be this long list of, you know, what's a mortal sin and what's a venial sin. And so I was deeply imbued with this sense of evil. And all of a sudden, I read Dante's Inferno, and there it is, right in front of me. And it's haunted me ever since. A few years later, I read Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, and when I read The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, I walked away from the Catholic Church and never went back. It was the most powerful piece of literature I'd ever read. And so I'm 76 years old at this point, and I have this long love-hate relationship with Catholicism. Some of my very closest male friends in the world were Catholic priests, and I maintained relationships with them until they died. We were friends. They never tried to get me back into the church. So that's the complicating piece.
Absolutely. For me, it's fascinating to hear about your catechism experience, because I too had a similar, but let's say somewhat more muted catechism mm-hmm. experience in the 1970s, and I too have walked away from that faith and found a new one. And it's so I understand.
So Catherine, when I was 8 years old, I asked a nun. I said, "What is eternity?" I didn't know what it was. And she said, okay, imagine a little sparrow comes down to a beach, picks up one grain of sand, and flies it all the way to the moon, which takes it several years. It drops the grain of sand, it comes back and gets another. And it keeps doing that until it's moved the whole earth to the moon. And then it starts taking everything back to earth, and it does that the number of times there are grains of sand. That kept me awake for nights. I was terrified of the concept of eternity.
Yes.
I didn't want it.
No, particularly the threat of roasting in hell for eternity. That's a pretty powerful and scary metaphor that you were provided with. Although I will say, you don't seem like a fearful person now. And so my sense is that writing this book has been a bit of a journey for you. And you've divided your book up into cantos, mm-hmm. as did Dante. Could you explain what a canto is and how that worked its way through your writing?
Yeah. I have to stress that I'm not a Dante scholar. I've read Dante. If you asked me to give a lecture on Dante, it would be about 8 minutes. The canto is a structure that's both musical and literary. And Ezra Pound, you know, wrote his poetry in cantos. So it's almost like verses. The term we would use today is chapters. And I loved the term canto, so I used it.
Absolutely. So I'm thinking about when I was reading the book, the cantos start out with the boreal forest, the river Styx, the corrections, and you keep moving through. Some of the takeaways for me were the concept of foraging, that played a role. You were talking about things like pine needle tea and cattail bread, which these are things I've never heard about. And I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about why you included that concept, and does foraging play mm-hmm. a role in your life?
Well, I think it's because the protagonist, who is a seriously burned out, pessimistic, environmental scientist at a university. He's just terrified about what the world is doing. And he heads off to do what the Australians call a walkabout, the Maori people, where you don't bring anything. You don't think about your survival. You go off into the woods and you walk and you think. And then, of course, he meets this odd old stranger in the woods, and they walk together. And this stranger, when all of a sudden he realizes he has to eat, starts to teach him about how much there is in the natural world to sustain us. So that's the pine needle tea and the cattails, which I've eaten, and leeches. He goes in to get the cattails and he gets leeches all over himself and comes out yelling and screaming, and Walt Whitman says, "No, don't throw those out. They're delicious."
Well, it certainly made an impression, and I have to ask you about the cattail bread. Does it taste good?
No. No.
but if you had to eat it and you knew that the water source was safe,
exactly.
Got it.
Exactly.
Got it. Well, if I'm ever lost in the woods, you're one of the people that I'd want to have in my party. So let's talk about his guide. So in Dante's Inferno, the guide was Virgil.
Yep.
And Virgil was eventually replaced by Beatrice, yep, Dante's beloved,
yep,
from afar. So in this case, it's Walt Whitman. Why did you choose Walt Whitman to be the guide for this environmental scientist?
It's one of those funny, sort of unanswerable questions. I mean, I've always loved Whitman's work. My own family, which was deeply immersed in literature on the Schubart side, were really transcendentalists. I mean, they loved Emerson and, you know, Thoreau. And all of a sudden, Walt Whitman comes along and breaks all the rules. You know, he's writing in free verse. He is assumed by most to be gay. And he's so deeply connected. I think it was not Leaves of Grass, which is a great work. It was a single poem called The Wound Dresser, where he goes down to try and find his brother, who's in the Union Army, and he sees all these men dying, and he essentially learns to become a nurse and just takes care of them while they're dying. And it's one of the most powerful pieces I've ever read. And why did I pick Walt Whitman? Because I think I felt I could learn from him. Both my protagonist character could learn from him, and I could as a writer.
I see. I have to say that in preparing to read your book, it inspired me to go back and read Dante and to read about Walt Whitman, because I knew that he was the guide, and it really enriched and broadened my understanding of their writing before I dove into your piece. I was thinking about how Whitman, in the book as the guide, talks about how there are lessons to be learned from the souls that they encounter on their journey. And I wonder, why do you think it's important that we pay attention to lessons that can be learned by those who go before us?
Well, I mean, I think, and it's so interesting today because, you know, I get tied into, you know, all the politics around higher education and, you know, our wonderful, and I don't mean this negatively, our very strong capitalist society puts immense value on STEM, as do I, because it's tied into the economy, it creates opportunity. And I look at all these humanities teachers who say, wait a sec, excuse me, just a minute. What? How do we contextualize? How do we make ethical decisions? And that was a big piece of this. I'm on a walkabout. I don't know where Whitman's taking me. And then he starts talking about the River Styx, you know, and the Inferno, and that's it. I mean, I really wanted to explore how the concept of evil has changed in 700 years. And I think, Catherine, the best example is the homicide section. In Dante's time, there were three ways to kill people. You could pierce their body with, a primitive knife. You could kill them with your hands, or you could poison them. And poisoning actually only came in, after a number of years. And today, we have tobacco, we have pharma, we have, industrial agriculture, we have nuclear war, we have drones. We have, and I use the word carefully, metastasized the concept of homicide, and in a funny way, almost made it invisible.
That's a powerful statement you just made, that in a funny way, we made it almost invisible. I'm thinking about the water of people who live in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
I think of cancer clusters in different communities across the country. Yep. My own hometown actually had a cancer cluster. So of children, and I won't name the business over the air, but absolutely. And it's invisible and it's insidious. And where does accountability factor?
And how does that tie into racism and bigots? What is familiarly called Cancer Alley is a black community.
Absolutely.
And Detroit. That section was primarily an African American community.
Exactly. No, I'm so glad. I think for me, one of the values of your book is that you are taking the concept of sin and you're bringing it into our contemporary lives, mm-hmm. and you're shining a light that might not otherwise have been shown. I wanted to invite you to talk about some of those other sins that you address through the contemporary lens, mm-hmm. the falsifiers.
Yeah, the falsifiers and the cozeners. I mean, I love language, and my wife Kate, who's my editor, says, "Now you can't just use big words because you're trying to tell people how smart you are, and yet, it's a distraction. They have to go look it up."
Well, actually, you always send me to the dictionary, and it's a good thing though. You're growing my vocabulary.
Well, I just fell in love with the term, partially because it was so beautifully sounding, cozeners. But, the falsifiers and the cozeners, and the wonderful old term, the artful deceiver, which I think is a 19th century British term. But, what has happened in the finance industry, what these huge companies have done at the retail banking level, and I won't go into detail, but starting up false accounts, and this one company that just agreed a couple of days ago to pay $1.85 billion settlement for student loans. It's become so. At what point does the beauty of mercantile capitalism, that has been so powerful and so created so much opportunity for people, at what point does it flip over ethically into sin? You know, I mean, it, you know, you've watched the museums all over the world scratching off the you know, the
who owned this originally?
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's so that's the, you know, the falsifiers and cozeners and cheaters. I mean, you know, the industrialized food industry putting sugar in everything, including, you know, tomato sauce, because they all of a sudden realized it was addictive. Tobacco, pharma, finance. I mean, it's
all over the place. And, you know, interestingly, when you talked about tobacco, one of the images that came to my mind was a photograph that was in the New York Times years ago when all these tobacco industry executives were testifying before Congress. And I remember looking at it thinking, what a bunch of deniers.
Yeah.
And what will their legacy be when their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren look at this ancient photograph of their ancestor.
Yeah. You know. Well, it's I know. I mean, and the difficulty is you hate to hoist everyone on the same petard. I've been through this with the Sackler family, who has threatened to sue me. They're the owners of Purdue Pharmaceutical.
Yes.
Because I've written extensively about the Sackler family and Purdue. And there are people in that family that were not engaged in the pharmaceutical stuff.
Yes.
You know, so it's, yet one has to be really careful to be fair.
Yes.
But
yes. Well, I am sorry to hear that they threatened you, though, because you're telling truth.
Well, it was a funny story. I don't know. I'll make it brief. I was at I was on a panel down at the lake, beautiful summer day, and my cell phone, all of a sudden I saw a text, which only usually comes from my children, and it was from this gigantic public relations firm, and it said, if you don't retract the statement you made about Richard Sackler this morning, in the next 5 hours we're going to sue you. So I sent back a text saying, you know, I'm on a panel right now with 70 people in front of me, can't talk, give you a buzz at 1 o'clock. Short story. I said, I fact checked what I wrote, and they said, well, you said that Richard Sackler was indicted. And that's not correct. He was charged. And I said, but he pled guilty and paid a $2.5 million fine, which to me would be like a parking ticket, you know. And anyway, I had used the wrong verb, so I changed it. I'm all about getting it right. And I said to the woman, I said, so do you enjoy your job? She's the reputation management agent for the family in this gigantic firm. She just went, oy vey, and hung up.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. Well, it sounds like you handled it very well, and you probably left her thinking after she put the phone down. So let's move on to sexual aggressors, and mm-hmm. what does that look like? And some of that is happening has happened right here in our community in Vermont.
It's intriguing to me because I never had, I mean, I was an older boy from the age of 6. I never had a bad experience in that way in the church. And yet it's just unfolding around the world. And I think it's important to indicate that it's not just Catholicism. Catholicism was the headline, but it's happening in all sort of ultra-Orthodox, you know, religions where it gives cover to mostly men to abuse children and women. And the idea, the cognitive dissonance of using spirituality and religion to cover for the sexual abuse of children, to me, is a horror. You know, I mean, Christ's statement, you know, suffer the little children. And I don't care what adults do with one another. That's their business. It's not my business. But boy, what you do to a child, is so critical. And it's constantly coming out how pervasive it is. I mean, Israel is struggling with it now in their ultra-Orthodox community. And part of the religious dogma is, if something does happen, you do not talk about it. And thank God that's changing, you know, with the whole Me Too movement. But, I don't know. It's just so troubling, and I don't know.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too. I think about your reference to children and the abuse of children, and what happens is that what is done to a child inappropriately, unless it's addressed head-on with some sort of amelioration, is likely to continue.
Absolutely.
And that's the enhanced danger of that concept of abuse. And
yeah. No, again, no digression, but I'm working with a group of pediatricians, a school superintendent, a former hospital director, on the concept of adverse childhood experiences.
Yes.
And there are many.
Yes.
You know, a parent in prison, an addicted parent, a child who's been physically or sexually abused. But the whole point is if that can be addressed early,
exactly,
with the family, then you don't get this intergenerational, you know,
cycle of abuse. There are ways to stop it.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And we need to be proactive. So I'm actually excited to hear that you're working on that.
I know it's a wonderful group of people, and boy, you know, I talked to the superintendent, and he said, I'm about education, and he said, I'm dealing with children who are so broken and so sad, self-harm, you know, eating disorders, and then he says, and then I get parents running down the corridor screaming and yelling about masks. He said, I just want to do education.
Absolutely. No, I do think that there is this greater awareness in our society that you can't expect a child who's hungry. You can't expect a child who's traumatized and has not had that trauma addressed. You can't expect them to sit there and do their math.
That's right.
Or
you're
to,
exactly right.
To do their
right.
writing. And so I feel like so much more is demanded of our educators right now. And
yeah.
I'm as grateful to the educators as I am to the medical professionals,
yep,
given the time that we find ourselves in. So you alluded to this a little bit, but I wondered if you could talk a bit more about your spiritual journey and
yeah.
how it has evolved over time, and ultimately, what would you call yourself, Bill, in 2022, if there is anything to call yourself?
It's interesting. At 76, I would call myself at this point a willing student of knowledge, beauty, and spirituality. And the older I get, the more I realize how much I don't know. I mean, my whole youthful arrogance, I'm going to live forever, I'm never going to die, I'm never going to get sick, everyone's going to love me, I've got all the answers. Watching that erode over the years to what you and I started talking about, which is curiosity. And you know, boy, that's interesting. I need to learn more about that. As you know, I'm a columnist, and I try to take very complicated stuff and talk about it in a way that doesn't polarize. And, you know, I always get a troll, you know, hurling a grenade over the social media thing, whatever. And I always write them back and say, I'm really, really appreciate you writing. Let's have coffee.
Right on, Bill.
Whoa. That the person either totally disappears or says, do you really mean it? And I have picked up more friends with whom I disagree, and I learn from them. You know, I wrote a piece about guns, and this absolute gun, you know, I have a right to own nuclear weapons if I want. And we have coffee every once in a while, and we talk. And the great thing is, we actually change each other's opinions. You know, so...
That's really beautiful. Years ago, I had a newspaper column here in Vermont, mm-hmm. and I love following yours on Digger, just saying, but I did get a couple of scary emails over the years, yep. and perhaps I didn't have the sense of safety or security or wisdom yet to recommend coffee. But if I ever go back to that, I just wrote this down, listeners. I think Bill has a wonderful suggestion, because how do you build bridges with people? So,
well, it calls their bluff too.
Yes.
I mean, the anonymity of social media.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like if I drive by your house and throw a firebomb across the thing and then race away, there's only one word to describe me. I'm a coward.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway.
Wow. It's just this reminder why I love talking with you, and I love having you on the show. So this is sort of a fun out there question that I came up with. So Bill, you've dedicated your time and your talent to diving in and crafting this novella, The Correctional Facility. I want you to imagine a book group attended by Dante, Whitman, and you. You've each just read The Correctional Facility, and you're poised to discuss the novella with glasses of Chianti. That's in deference to our dear Florentine Dante. And you're sitting in your living room here in Vermont. So what might Dante like or dislike about the book, and how might Whitman receive it in your mind?
Well, I think I would start out by raising a glass of Chianti and saying, gentlemen, I'd like to beg your forgiveness. Because as I said earlier, I'm not a Dante scholar. And I just have to mention another Burlingtonian, Seth Steinzor, who I believe is a retired attorney, has actually done a modern translation of the entire Commedia and the Divine Comedy. And it imagine the serendipity of, you know, two people living in Burlington, Vermont, one rewriting, you know, the book to his own purpose, and the other doing a scholarly translation. Anyway, I've read the first translation, and it's really wonderful. But I'm not enough a scholar to know what to compare it to. Anyway, back to your question. I say apologize because there's a huge amount of presumption in just assuming somebody of the stature of Dante and certainly Whitman. Whitman clearly has a rich and wonderful sense of humor, so I think he would probably toast me back and say, happy to be used. And then again, for what we talked about learning, I would say, what have I done? What have I wrought? What did you understand by my using you to do this? And then, of course, we'd have a conversation that would go on all night and involve several more bottles of Chianti. and what I would want and hope is that I know Dante would speak in the colloquial, and I know that Whitman would discourse in a mixture of song and prose, because that's so much about, you know, I mean, so many of his poems are declarative, you know. So I can't imagine anything more fun. Can you make it happen?
You never know with the wonders of current technology.
Oh,
But you know, that's actually a conversation that I want to be a fly on the wall for. And I have to say, Bill, I recognize and respect the fact that you've said a couple times you are not a scholar of Dante. And it's so important to have those scholarly folks.
Yeah.
The beauty of this work is that you brought your passion and your curiosity for Dante to the writing of this book, which I think one of the most powerful aspects of it is that it makes Dante accessible,
mm-hmm.
and it allows us to look at his work through a contemporary lens.
Mm-hmm.
And just as in the case of me, you sent me to Dante to prepare before mm-hmm. I read your book. But I do think, though, that we have to give ourselves credit as strivers, as curious strivers mm-hmm. who are trying to learn more about the world around
yeah.
us. So I appreciate your curious mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And one other thing that I really have to say that I think is important, you remember talking about my fear of infinity, also my fear of fire. And that's why when we come over, cross the River Styx, and we go down, and I'm expecting to see these burning fire pits with people screaming, and I just, as far as the eye can see, I see concrete. And it's the idea of a modern correctional facility as hell, you know, was really important to me. And the fact that concrete is not alive, it's not organic. I also have to say, Jeff Danziger, who you know, is a, you know, internationally known illustrator and cartoonist, Washington Post. He and I worked very closely on this, and he did an extraordinary job.
Amazing.
You know, there's about 16 or 17 illustrations that really, to me, brought the book to life. And he didn't do his own thing. He did my thing in his way. And that partnership was really special.
And, you know, I have to say, I would agree with you in that his illustrations really draw out your words. Draw out your words so amazingly. Mm-hmm. And I want to give you a quick moment to ask you, what was most meaningful for you about writing this book?
I'm sorry, about?
About writing the book. What was most meaningful for you?
I think it was just the ability to go deeply into my own consciousness and try and create some clarity, some understanding of what all these youthful experiences are. How did I relate to sin? How did I relate to Catholicism? What did I feel about infinity? What did I feel about burning? You know, all these things, they were roiling around inside me. And the opportunity to just encase them in a small novella was amazingly helpful. I don't know how to describe it. It's
you just did.
I needed to do it. And it didn't answer all the questions, but it helped me understand the experience.
Beautifully said, Bill. Beautifully said. Well, we always run out of time when we talk. And I want to thank Bill Schubart, Vermont author, for appearing on Present Time to talk about his new book, The Correctional Facility. Bill, where can people find your book?
It's available at all Vermont bookstores. It's distributed internationally by Ingram. So any bookstore anywhere in the world can order it. If you have trouble finding it, you can go to my website, schubart.com, and get it. It's available pretty much everywhere.
Well, listeners, I will be posting Bill's website on the Present Time Facebook page. Thank you, Bill, so much for appearing on Present Time.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I always look forward to our conversations.
Wonderful. And from the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Thanks for listening.